From KCRW, I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business. Sometimes our guests have so much good stuff to say that we can't fit it all into one episode. So this week, we're bringing you some delicious leftovers.
You know, in those first meetings, like if the person is cool or not.
But I wasn't learning any hip hop over the summer, so I'd go back to school and I'd be, hey, do you guys know about Billy Idol? They'd be like, shut the hell up.
He said, you're making the biggest mistake of your life.
First, Gina Prince-Bythewood, director of the Netflix film The Old Guard, shares advice for women filmmakers who want to get into directing action movies. Then, Prentice Penny, showrunner of HBO's Insecure, talks about how he thinks learning to code switch as a kid in Los Angeles, shuttling between the black and white worlds, helped him build a career. Finally, we'll hear from Peter Medak, who made the documentary The Ghost of Peter Sellers about his nightmare experience working with the comedy icon. He tells us about a fateful decision in the early days of his career. But first, while I'm on a break, Matt banters with a guest banterer. Stick around, it's The Business from KCRW.
I'm Matt Bellany, in for Kim Masters this week, and our guest banterer is The Hollywood Reporter's Tatiana Siegel. Hello, Tatiana.
Hello, Matt.
So, Tatiana, you've been at the center of a story that broke this week that is pretty extraordinary, even for Hollywood. It concerns Ron Meyer, who, for those who don't know, Ron Meyer is somewhat of an unofficial mayor of Hollywood. He co-founded the CAA agency. He had been at Universal in various roles for 25 years, running the studio. He's currently vice chair of NBC Universal. And he was ensnared by what he called an extortion attempt by someone close to an actress who had allegedly been trying to get money out of him and was threatening to expose the affair and implicate NBC Universal in what he called a false way. He abruptly stepped down this past week. And yes, it's unusual that a studio executive would step down citing an extortion attempt from a former mistress. But what's really strange in this case is that it's the same woman who was at the center of another studio head's fall 17 months ago, Kevin Sugihara. This actress, Charlotte Kirk, is now in the center of these two scandals that have brought down two of the most powerful men in Hollywood. Now, Tatiana, you've been at the center of this story doing extensive reporting along with Kim Masters, and you actually broke the Kevin Sugihara story. So who is Charlotte Kirk?
She's somebody who popped onto the Hollywood scene back in 2012. She was 19 years old, a British actress, wanted to be an actress, and she showed up at the Cannes Film Festival where she appeared in a documentary by James Toback, who has since been accused of sexual assault by dozens of women. And the movie was interesting because it's about this actress who sort of making the rounds with powerful people, and that's what she sort of became, because within a year, she's in Hollywood. She's dating James Packer. She suddenly meets Kevin Sugihara. And that begins the story that we reported back in 2019 about Kevin Sugihara appearing to use his power to get her auditions and roles in films. That was backed up by text messages that were irrefutable, although he still maintains that he had no involvement in her getting roles, even though it's pretty black and white. But in any case, she also had met Ron Meyer that same year, 2012. I'm told they met in London, and she was 19. He would have been like 67, 68. And his situation was a little different than Kevin's. He kind of kept it not involved with the studio, but he did have this relationship with her. And then this week, he abruptly resigns. He doesn't name the woman at the center of why he was stepping down. But I then reported that it was Charlotte Kirk. And then the next thing you know, it's like 17 months apart, two of the most powerful men down because of the same woman. And the latest with Charlotte is that she dropped out of a Q&A session that was to take place that had been previously scheduled before this second scandal broke.
Interesting. You know, it's no secret that there has been a long history of, you know, womanizing men in all industries, but especially in Hollywood. But something about the reckoning that's going on in the industry and elsewhere over the past 3 years since the revelations about Harvey Weinstein have made these stories appear, in my opinion, more prominent than they would have been in the past. You agree with that?
Absolutely. And there's also the added element that she was a woman who was, you know, just out of her, she was 19, 20, 21 when she's with these men, has autism or Asperger's. And there's a, you know, a power dynamic that's undeniable here. Anybody who's the boss of Kevin Shujihara or Ron Meyer is going to say, this isn't acceptable anymore in 2020. Even though it's legal, whatever, it's like there is a perception of abuse of power.
Yeah, and that's an interesting one, because I remember this came up when we were reporting on the Shujihara situation, because, you know, it was not a cut and dry Me Too situation, because these were consensual affairs. But there is this interesting dynamic where you have very powerful men in an industry that is very difficult to break into. And this appears to be someone who very badly wanted to be part of that industry and saw an opportunity or was seduced by the allure of these men who are gigantic gatekeepers. And it just adds another nuance to this notion of what an imbalance of power is in these situations.
Absolutely. And I kind of call it Me Too adjacent. The story of Charlotte Kirk, like it's not Me Too, but it's kind of, it has elements there that you can't deny.
And reading a lot of those text messages that you reported on, you know, there was an ickiness to the whole thing, where there was an implicit, you know, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours, while not explicitly saying, you know, if you meet me at the Bel Air Hotel, I will find movie roles for you.
Right. Although at some point there were text messages that indicated that there had been absolutely promises that in return for sex, I would get such and such auditions. And at some point, I'm going to paraphrase here, but Brett Ratner, the filmmaker who was involved in this scandal as somebody who had sort of done interference between Charlotte and Kevin Shujihara, he said in a text message to Charlotte something that has probably been said 1,000 times by Hollywood men, which is, you didn't really think that sleeping with him meant that he would give you these roles, did you? Like, that's what he said just to sleep with you. And it's sort of like that kind of, in a way, was, I'm paraphrasing, but that was sort of that was the most illuminating moment out of Brett's mouth.
Well, we talk about this reckoning that's been going on for the past few years. I mean, it really has touched NBC Universal in a way that is heightened beyond other companies. I mean, if you look at what's gone on there at NBC News with the Matt Lauer situation, and then even this past week with Paul Telegdi, the former head of NBC, stepping down amid some allegations of not, you know, this kind of behavior, but improper workplace behavior, where he had been accused of making insensitive remarks and doing things that were offensive to people that he worked with. You know, this is something that just, this wave continues to sweep over the industry. And it keeps coming back to this question of, why is NBC Universal at the center of so many of these controversies?
It would appear that they have a culture problem, which is something that has been reported very well by The Hollywood Reporter and has been sort of been the open secret in Hollywood. And it extends to New York, where NBC News had, you know, a lot of problems where female staffers had complained of casual misogyny all the way to like being overlooked for positions because they were women, et cetera, et cetera. And then you have the whole scandal of them not taking Ronan Farrow's Harvey Weinstein story in the first place. And did they, you know, cover it up? And it ended up at the New Yorker magazine. and it won a Pulitzer Prize. So one would think it had the journalistic credibility to be published, but it didn't. And I think there's a lot of questions about the entire corporation.
Well, and now Jeff Shell, who has just been installed as the CEO of NBC Universal, really has a task on his hands. And ironically, Jeff Shell really was mentored by Ron Meyer. When he came to Universal in LA, Shell had been a Comcast executive based out of London and really didn't know the film business or Hollywood in general. And Ron Meyer was one of the people that had really taken him under his wing, showed him how the business operates. And, you know, now one of his first jobs is to let Ron Meyer go. That's an interesting turn of events as well.
It mirrors the Kevin Shujihara-John Stankey relationship. Very similar. John Stankey would come to Hollywood and Kevin would bring him to the premieres and the Oscars. And, you know, because these guys, they're not Hollywood players.
Yeah, John Stankey was with AT&T.
Yeah, exactly. Somebody's got to move up.
All right. Thank you, Tatiana.
You're welcome.
That's Tatiana Siegel, executive film editor at The Hollywood Reporter. I'm Matt Bellany, filling in for Kim Masters.
Dina Prince-Bythewood directed The Old Guard, which, according to Netflix, quickly rose to be one of the streamer's hits of the summer. When Prince-Bythewood started making the film, she had never directed a superhero movie. That job, in essence, requires a director to command an army. Prince-Bythewood did not approach the challenge casually. I asked her if she had any advice for women directors looking to break into action.
You know, foremost, it starts with that first meeting. It starts before that. Have a strong vision, know what you want, and be prepared, be over-prepared. So that when you get into these meetings, you know what you're talking about. You can articulate your vision, but also then be open and excited to be talking with people who do know this aspect of the job better than you, and learn from that and use them to help elevate your own vision. So if you have the confidence going in of your vision, then it's much easier to keep yourself open to hear other ideas. Because ultimately it is collaborative, and that's where the best work comes in, is being collaborative. And you, to have really good action sequences, it is an absolute team effort. It starts with that vision at the top, but then you want all these ideas and you want somebody to throw out something and then you say something that builds on it and then they throw out something. It's just this great thing, but it starts with you having the confidence to open yourself up to that. The other thing is, you know, in those first meetings, like if the person is cool or not. And, you know, I met with a couple people and there was somebody I didn't end up meeting with. You know, he's considered one of the absolute best. But I also heard from too many people that he was not always a nice person. And life is too short. Like, just being talented is not an excuse to be an asshole. And there are going to be other people. And I ended up getting, I think, the best in the business. And they're all really good guys. So don't set yourself up for failure there as well. And believing that it's okay. You may have to put up with some bad behavior to get a good product. That I do not subscribe to that at all. As I said, what we do is way too hard to have somebody poison the mix and make it uncomfortable and make it not fun, because it should be fun, what we're doing. So, that's my two pieces of advice.
Coming up after the break, more tasty leftovers. Insecure showrunner Prentice Penny talks about how his upbringing taught him to be comfortable working in a majority white writer's room. And Peter Medak, who was a guest on the show to talk about his doc, The Ghost of Peter Sellers, tells us about turning down a great gig early in his career. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. This has been a big year for Prentice Penny, the showrunner of HBO's Insecure. In its fourth season, the series received its first Emmys nod for Best Comedy. Penny also wrote and directed the Netflix film Uncorked, about a son who defies his father and becomes a sommelier. He's also signed on to direct a holiday movie for Netflix, and on top of all that, he's working on Insecure's fifth season. Penny had an interesting upbringing in L.A., and it influenced his career.
Yeah, I mean, I'm from L.A., so I was born and raised not far. I grew up in like View Park, Lake Lambert Park, Crenshaw area. The short version is my parents divorced when I was four, and my parents had two different views of how I needed to move through the world. My mom was a lawyer, so she wanted me to do everything white kids did. So if it was white, it was right. And so my dad was like, we have a furniture store in Compton. He needs to be around black people all the time. And so everything he wanted to do was super black. And so when they divorced, they had this kind of agreement. Before there was like a thing called diversity, it was if I went to like the black school in Windsor Hills or Lemur Park, that then I had to go to summer camp and play sports with white kids and vice versa. So like I'd be spending my, you know, I'd be in third grade and I was listening to like a lot of early hip hop, obviously like Run DMC and LL Cool J. But then I went to this all-white summer camp in the Valley where they were listening to the Bangles and the Go-Go's. And I was like, I don't know any of this music. And I spent all summer trying to learn all my white songs, like learn Culture Club, learn The Police. And then, but I wasn't learning any hip-hop over the summer. So I'd go back to school and I'd be, hey, do you guys know about Billy Idol? They'd be like, shut the hell up. And that was my life for like 8 years. But really what it taught me was to always have like, I learned things and I was comfortable in spaces. I learned how to be comfortably uncomfortable no matter where I kind of went. And it opened me up for a lot of different things. And so that served me well when I was in film school. And at the summer camp, I was the only black kid. So it served me well when I was in film school and I was the only one. It served me well when I'd go into white writer rooms and be the only one. You know, it wasn't a foreign space for me that intimidated me to do what I still needed to do. And so, but basically I went to USC to film school. After that, I kind of bounced around trying various things. Working in music video spaces, working in early animation and internet stuff. And then finally, I got my first job on Girlfriends as like a staff writer.
And you worked on various shows, Girlfriends, and then you...
I worked on Girlfriends for 4 years. And that was such a great space because like, when I was on that show, like out of that show, obviously Mara Brock-Akil, who's amazing, but Regina Hicks... who's an amazing writer, Karen Gist, who runs Grownish and who ran Star. Obviously, Kenya Barris was on staff with me. Lena Waith was an assistant back then. Matthew Cherry was a PA when I was there. So all these, this great, you know, talent now that's like, yeah, like doing that. It was like a murderer's row. And it was such a, I equated the closest thing I can compare it to. It was like my wife went to an HBCU. She went to Spelman and she just talks about how everybody was so supportive of the years. And I didn't go to an HBCU, but that's what that show felt like to me, was like watching black people be great and talented and amazing. And then I went to go work on, then they started canceling all the shows post the writer's strike, shows of color. So then that was my foray into white shows. And, you know, because those shows are always heralded, I remember being like, oh, I'm going to be around writers that are on like Friends and this and that. And so I was a little intimidated when I first got there. And then when I got into the rooms, I was like, oh, this is just like every other room that I was in on Girlfriends. And these writers are no more talented than the writers I was working with, you know? And so.
Yeah, I would think possibly less, actually, given the talent you just named. Yeah.
It just gets built up. And so those were all great writers, too. But they were no more funnier or talented than the people I had been working with. It's just you hear the names of those shows and the shows those people had been on. And also what it showed me when I first went into that world was also like the conversations they were having was not like the conversations the writers on Girlfriends were having, where you know, these writers were talking about big overall deals on the white shows I was on, and I just wasn't hearing those conversations. They just weren't being always afforded those opportunities, like back then. And so, but I worked on a show called Do Not Disturb, Scrubs, Breaking In, Happy Endings. That took me to Brooklyn Nine-Nine, and then I left Brooklyn Nine-Nine to show run Insecure.
Yeah, someone told me that I can't remember who, this is driving me nuts, but very recently someone, I mentioned we were going to be talking, and someone said that you asked this person to put in a word with Issa Rae when you wanted to do Insecure.
Yeah, it was actually Lena. Lena was friends with Issa from...
Oh, maybe I read that.
Yeah, it was Lena was friends with Issa from having done like Justin Simien's Dear White People. And because I, you know, like Lena was an assistant when we met and we had stayed friends all that time, I was like, hey, you guys are friends. Can you like put in a word? And she did. And it was great because also like vice versa on the flip of that, when you know, Melina Matsoukas worked on Insecure and shot our pilot. And so when Lena was like, hey, I want to be thinking about doing the Thanksgiving episode. Can you talk to Melina to see if she'd be interested? And I did. And so that's just the beauty of the full circle of Lena and I's friendship, and just how the world works, and you never really know how those things are gonna, you know, kind of come full circle.
You might remember our interview with Peter Medak, who made The Ghost of Peter Sellers, a documentary about the ordeal of trying to make the 1973 pirate comedy Ghost in the Noonday Sun, with a very uncooperative Peter Sellers. But Medak also told us about a fateful decision early in his career. In the 1960s, Medak had a deal to be an assistant director at Universal, where he encountered the late Sid Sheinberg. Sheinberg was on his way to becoming president of MCA and Universal Studios, a powerful position that he held for nearly 40 years. But then he was a lawyer, offering Medak a chance to stay with the studio.
And I wanted to make films. And I told Sid Sheinberg, who was in charge of me, they said, the boys want to pick up your option for next year. And I said, that's wonderful. But I decided that I want to make my first film, Negatives, with this unknown, wonderful British actress called Glenda Jackson. And I'm not coming back. And Sidney said to me, and these were his words, he said, you're making the biggest mistake of your life because everybody loves you here, but it's up to you. So I didn't come back. And then Steven Spielberg got that same position in the new projects department, who then started observing at the studio and then eventually made his first short film about that truck, you know, called The Duel. I think it was called Duel, you know.
Yeah, I think that rings a bell, yeah. It worked out for him, yeah. Of course, he and Sid were very close to the bitter end.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why Steven is still at Universal, because of his relationship to Sid or Mr. Sheinberg, you know, who I loved, and he was an incredible mentor of my life.
He was very good to me. He was the first person who would talk to me when I started covering this beat. And I went to this sort of small funeral that I was invited to go, and I wrote about him and what he was like, to how he treated me. And Stephen actually sent me a note saying, very nice note about the piece. So that was like a real beginning to end experience, you know.
I know. He was an amazing guy, Sid, you know. And I saw him maybe 3-4 years before he passed away. And I insisted to take him out for lunch, which I did.
And he wasn't well, of course.
He wasn't, poor darling, you know.
I saw him just a few weeks before he died, and I hugged him, and it was like a little sack of sticks. And he was such a powerful man, you know. There were a couple of questions I wanted to get back to about you and the film. So your film, the Peter Sellers film, never was released?
No, it wasn't released through the studio, through Columbia, no.
Because they didn't want to put the marketing behind it, or what?
No, because of Peter's complications, there was like 14 days Peter physically wasn't there on the film. And I couldn't shoot. I was 14 days short of shooting certain scenes on the film. And we tried to cut the script and change the script and alter it, you know. But the studio felt that because those scenes weren't shot and they were kind of action sequences, you know, like in Pirates of Caribbean, you know, they refused to accept the film. And John Heyman, who pre-financed the movie, he put up all the money himself.
So he was holding the bag, yeah.
Yeah, John was an incredible... when I did this interview with John, it went on for 2.5 hours. And we were talking about all kinds of other things besides just us, in order to get him going and to get him talking about the movie. And he talks about financing movies in the 70s and financing movies today. And it is the most incredible lecture from a great entrepreneur, producer, broker. And he actually says in the documentary that, you know, I'm not really a producer. I was a broker for some of these movies, you know. And the real movies I produced, you fell in love with, and your movie was just an item. It was just an inventory on my financing. And anyhow, he single-handedly created independent financing in England in the late 60s and 70s.
Right. So he was a money man.
He was a money, yeah, absolutely. A very, very, very tough money man.
Mm-hmm.
And when I showed the film, the documentary, to David Heyman, and I knew David, you know, from John's office from 40 years ago when he was a young boy hanging around when I went to the meetings, you know.
Yes.
I wanted him to see the film, but he sent me this incredible email afterwards, you know, and he said to me also on the phone, you know, he said, I am a different kind of producer from my dad. And it was incredible watching him in your documentary and seeing him to be so incredibly articulate and wonderful about explaining everything. But he said, I have to tell you that he should have been there with you. And these were David's words. And I'm really quoting him. And he said, when the going gets rough, a producer has to be there to support his director. And my dad didn't come there in your rescue and your aid. His reading of it and opinion of it was a wonderful kind of revelation to me to hear.
And that's The Business. Kevin Tidmarsh produced and edited today's program. Paul Smith mixed the show. You can stream The Business as well as other great KCRW podcasts on the KCRW app. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.